Welcome to the Royal Diaries, Unlocking History. My name is Felicia.
My name is Julia. We are sisters who love books, history, and talking about them both.
We're doing a deep dive into the Royal Diaries series.
Come with us as we learn about the girls who became women that shaped history.
We're on book three of the Royal Diaries series. Isabel, Jewel of Castilla.
Is it Castilla or is it like Castile, like the soap?
We'll just say Castile because that's how everyone else in the anglicized world spells it.
Good to know.
The summary. While waiting anxiously for others to choose a husband for her, Isabel, the future queen of Spain, keeps a diary account of her life as a member of the royal family.
Who wrote it, by the way?
This was written by Carolyn Meyer.
Okay.
So this takes place in 1466. In Spain.
Is it Spain at this point, or is it still the divided kingdoms?
Technically, it is Castile and Leon.
I see.
What were your thoughts, etc., about this book? The reason why I'm rushing through this is I have a lot of history to get into, and it's not just about her, but because when you talk about peak times in history, this lady's life covers so many different areas of it.
Because the thing that I noticed the most while I was reading this book, I was, oh, hey, that's a name drop. I know that.
Okay, so example.
Richard, Duke of Gloucester.
Oh, yeah, my fate. Richard III, R.I.P. True King of England.
Amen.
Yeah, so things like that where she's, maybe I'll get married to this guy.
I wish, except not.
I mean, he and Anne Neville had OTP, true historical love, in my opinion.
I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Talk to me about the book. Thoughts, likes, concerns, feelings, emotions.
So,
what did you know before?
I knew that she was a big deal in Spain, first female regent, being a ruler in her own right. I'm just going to say it. I know that she is like the grand high priestess, queen mother of colonization, North America and South America. So I knew that going in, but honestly, like, no offense to Spain. I do not know this man. I do not
know
your history.
In terms of the history?
Yeah.
So when I first read this book, I remember distinctively when I got it, my impression was, man, this Isabel is a fun suck.
She's a major fun suck, really self-righteous. I'll be honest with you. When I first read this book, I was probably around 10, 11 years old. I knew that anti-Semitism was not a great thing, but I was not super well schooled in it. And even child me was, this seems a little bit rude and suspect about,
well,
Jewish people.
If Isabel were to be like a character in a movie, I just think about Wyonik Ryder's character, Charlotte in Mermaids, and
oh
how
my God, yes.
Even though it's like Charlotte were Jewish, she becomes obsessed with Catholicism,
yeah,
and tries to be a Catholic, and her mom keeps reminding her Charlotte were Jewish. Her mom's like Cher, so it's even better.
Yeah, but then also like Isabel, she gets distracted by the hot boy.
Which totally happens to Charlotte in Mermaids, and she's, oh God, my soul, I'm going to die. Here I'm kissing a boy, and I'll become pregnant by kissing him, mm-hmm, and I'll never get to a convent. My life is ruined, so.
Pretty much.
Basically, that is Isabel in this book.
She is a major fuddy-duddy. Elizabeth, she was third in line, somehow became queen. Mm-hmm. Cleopatra, well, we got all into that.
Yeah,
mess.
She was not supposed to be queen. And Isabel is another one of those not supposed to be queens.
Mm-hmm.
So we keep having this running theme of women in their childhood formative years not expected to be anything, and then they become landmark historical figures.
Mm-hmm.
Besides that, though, in the book, it's interesting too how they sort of fast forward through the timeline.
Totally.
I have nothing to write about, so then she doesn't write for a year. So I think the book starts when she's like, what, 14? And it's like 18.
Yeah.
They do a lot of skipping ahead, hit the highlights,
mm-hmm,
of her family drama with her half-brother Enrique, depressive mother,
mm-hmm,
and her younger brother who's Alfonso, who's trying to take the throne.
Yep.
Who's she gonna get married off to?
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, yikers, anti-Semitism.
Majorly.
With like her lady-in-waiting, Catalina, who, is she a quote-unquote real Christian, even though her family's been converted since, you know, the 1340s?
And even if she wasn't, we
doesn't
should
matter.
Her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Her BFF, Beatrice.
Stabby McStabstab.
Stabby McStabstab, a feminist icon. When I was a child reading this, I was,
really?
I love Beatrice. She's my fave.
Fair enough. I mean, she definitely at least, she actually like tries to do shit.
As opposed to Isabel just being like, I guess I'm just guilty of the sin of pride, not eating fun food. Isabel.
Please.
Please.
One thing that when she was, my education stopped when I was 12, and how, despite the fact that she is of royal blood, she wouldn't have access to certain education, and how deep the misogyny is too as well.
Yeah, wrapping up with her, the religious teaching being, well, women are inferior to men, ergo they shouldn't learn it, and women are inferior to men because this fall of mankind into sin was because of Eve and women.
Exactly.
Etc.
How much truth is in that?
Her attitudes about herself.
Attitudes about herself and attitudes about other people too, though, right? Not even just like the anti-Semitism, but difference and also how geopolitics works, right? She definitely was the, yeah, she was the iron fist, case in the iron fist, from what I know of her. So, well, I don't know. Not to go and say that education totally disfuses you of ignorance, but I always am curious about that.
Like, what is the motivation?
Motivation? Like, where are the pitfalls in someone's worldview and what might have influenced them to have those blind spots? Not to say that racism and anti-Semitism are quote-unquote blind spots, but you get
No,
right?
It's, and Isabel is definitely one of those things, if you want to get into the whole nature versus nurture thing. I'll dive into it in terms of her story, her backstory, and then where it meets when we're talking about this diary. Isabel doesn't just wake up one day and I think I'm going to be super religious and persecute people.
Yeah,
like,
God.
There's got to be a reason for it. I'm going to get into the history because, frankly, to be honest, in this book, a lot of it gets touched on, but I'm going to get into more of the deeper dive in it. Buckle up, Buttercup. There is a lot to cover.
But also, too, this book was freaking boring.
It was boring. And the most interesting thing was when she was weirdly obsessed with Fernando, and then she didn't meet him, and then she finally did. And then it was very anticlimactic. Instead of writing the end, I'll write the beginning. And actually, that's when things get interesting.
Of course. I just want to say, for me, the most interesting, because I only am here for the food, mother, was when they're like, lamb and saffron rice.
Like, that sounds delicious.
I want to eat that.
Okay, finding a historical book about Isabel, a lot of this stuff, let me talk about the New World, let me talk about the Borgias, let me talk about Muslim Spain, but in terms of talking about just Isabel,
like a biography,
it's difficult to find that. Even though there are plenty of primary resources, Peter the Martyr wrote about it. He lived there and then he went to Rome. He was living it and he wrote about it. But in terms of finding like newer books about Isabel, there's always that question of how much was Isabel? How much was Fernando? Blah, blah, blah. I'm here to set the record straight. It was probably Isabel.
Makes sense.
And you'll see why.
Oh, God.
Okay.
I'm just, again, it's just, I know that this is going to be a never-ending pinata of, oh, God, why?
But no, still. It's like Inception. Imagine the tightest season of a TV show. So many things happened in one season. How is this one season of television? That's what happens in 1 year of her reign. I couldn't make this up. Sometimes in TV, you know how they fudge the lines historically and they cram 3 years of drama into one season and they make it seem like events just happen boom, boom, boom. And then later on, you're like, oh, there was 10 years in between this.
Yeah.
No, IRL 1492 was a killer year in terms of so many things happened.
Okay,
this is me starting.
I was about to say. But when you said killer, it was also a killer for the indigenous people.
For
of the
everybody.
Americas.
Everybody died.
Oh, God.
All right. Traditionally, we know her as Queen Isabel. I'm just gonna say Isabel because it's just easier that way, even though people want to say Isabella.
Mm-hmm.
Also, do not rag on me for my bad Spanish accent. Queen Isabel was an extraordinary influential woman of her time. Her impact and decisions continue to influence both old and new worlds long after her death. She's often portrayed as merely a loyal spouse to her husband Ferdinand of Aragon. In reality, she was a strong, independent, ambitious figure in her own right. She survived numerous challenges to become Queen of Castile in 1474, her marriage to Fernando, then heir of the neighboring Kingdom of Aragon, eventually resulted in a united Spain. Isabel's reign can basically be summarized by Newton's third law.
Oh, Jesus.
For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. For every yay thing in her reign, there is usually a more devastating nay.
Wow.
So let's talk about what this book was covering. Born in 1451, Isabel was not expected to become Castile's queen. Her father, King Juan II, was 1949 when he married his second wife, Isabella Portugal, who was 19. Here we go. Isabella Portugal had two children, Isabel and Alfonso. It's unknown if she had postnatal depression, but people were like, why is she so sad after having children? When her husband died, the son of the first marriage, Enrique, inherited Castile's throne. FYI, her stepson was 3 years older than her.
That would be like the most awkward family dinner.
It gets worse in terms of awkward family dinners.
Oh, God.
For Isabel of Portugal was now a widow, the rule was, if you want to keep your widow's pension, you have to be chaste. So it's heavily implied that Pedro Grillon, brother of King Enrique's favorite, Juan Pachado, either attempted to woo or maybe assault her while she was by herself, so Enrique wouldn't have to pay for her anymore. And that's alluded to in this book.
It is alluded to.
About how he made a pass at her. It was more than just making a proposal that was indecent,
you know?
Isabel of Portugal closeted herself into a dark room, self-condemned to silence, and dominated by such a depression that it degenerated into a form of madness.
She had maybe postpartum depression. She had a dead husband who was also probably like a major creep too. And then she probably was assaulted. Yeah, I would probably go and have a bit of a breakdown too.
Yes, you have to be here by yourself if you want to keep your two kids.
Yeah.
So she was also very religious, obviously. If you don't have anyone else to turn to, you're going to turn to Jesus maybe. So this was Isabel's sort of training and leaning into faith when in helpless situations. Regardless of her piety and chastity, Isabel did lose custody of her children in 1461 when Enrique's second wife, Juana of Portugal, in a strange way, they are ish related.
Okay.
But not actually related.
Okay.
It's very confusing because you have people who are remarrying people and you have people who are marrying cousins, who are marrying nieces and nephews. It's just a mess.
Oh. This is like the Ptolemies.
It is, actually. And actually, there's an interesting connection there, too. Ancient Greeks and Spaniards' belief of where they came from.
Really? Ooh, I'm excited for that.
Exactly. But regardless, Isabel of Spain later wrote of this time, when my brother Alfonso and I were children, we were forcibly and intentionally taken from the arms of our mother and raised under the authority of Queen Dona Juana, which also sounds really funny if you say it fast. It was a dangerous guardianship for us and had infamous influences. I remember in my place to avoid immorality, taking care of my honor and fearing for my life.
Oof.
So it was not a very secure childhood.
Kind of like Queen Elizabeth.
Exactly. So Juana of Portugal was the second wife Enrique. His first marriage was allegedly unconsummated, and it wasn't Enrique's fault, obvi.
Of course.
It had to be the woman's. So he was allowed to get a new wife. 6 years after marrying Juana, Enrique had a daughter, also called Juana. Or did he? Dun, dun, dun.
And they did talk about that in the book, right?
Yes.
Like, that was a big plot point, which as a small child, I was scandalized.
I know.
Why would you do that to your wife?
Or I was more along the lines of, she had someone else's baby. Yeah, Beltran de la Cueva, who is the real baby daddy. Or was he? He probably was.
Probably.
We'll get into that. Queen Juana later had another child, and this is also talked about in this book.
Mm-hmm.
While she and Enrique were separated during a civil war, she was hiding at the bishop's palace for safety, and she found it in the bishop's nephew's bed.
Oh my God.
See what I did there?
I did see what you did there.
So at this point, when she shows up fully pregnant, has a baby, and is, you haven't seen the king in like 2 years. Obviously, it is not his baby.
Mm-hmm.
Yikes. But don't judge Queen Juana too harshly. For reasons that will come up in a bit, Enrique was not a good husband, and if the first tenet of marriage is loyalty, it didn't exist for him either.
He was literally a dirtbag.
He was literally a dirtbag.
Literally a dirtbag, and probably a dirtbag on multiple levels, if from what I know about men, but royal men in particular.
It's true. So back to Isabel's education. It was solid, but it was limited to protocol, domestic skills, grammar, philosophy, and history. She was multilingual, so she knew Spanish, French, Italian, Portuguese, but unlike a man or a soon-to-be king, she had no Latin, which was the language of international and ecclesiastical diplomatship.
Makes sense.
So she couldn't read any of the actual official documents. Ooh.
And she never learned it?
No, she actually did later on in her life, and that was a big pain sticking point. My kids will have the better than I had. That was Isabel. So she actually was, my girls are going to learn exactly the same as the boys, and I'm going to train them all to be queens.
Nice.
So, and I'll get into that a little later when I talk about her family. She grew up near an active Franciscan monastery, and they show that in the book, how she goes to visit the monks. So religious scholars and teaching were part of her education. She was a big fan of Franciscans.
I mean,
like, they were her faves.
I mean, from what I know of the Franciscans, they are apparently pretty baller.
Yeah, they're pretty dope and down to earth.
Yeah.
So she liked them. So in the book, we have Clara Alvernez, Isabel's governess,
mm-hmm.
a real person.
Oh.
Yep. Beatrice, my fave. She was also a real person.
Okay.
Her actual BFF.
Oh.
Brilliant ally and strategist. Her family had served as chief of the treasury and had actually been ambassadors to the Pope at one point.
Dang.
So she was in the circle. Pedro Grillon, aka the guy who probably tried to assault her mom, and actual suitor to Isabel when her brother was, you should hook up with my favorite's brother.
Yeah.
And then Isabel in the book was, God, him or me. And Beatrice was, don't worry, I got a knife. It's not going to be you. But this really happened. Isabel legitimately prayed, God, it's him or me. So please make this not happen. And Pedro died. So Isabel was, number one, God is real. Number two, God listens to me when things are terrible. This is a key takeaway that goes in her life.
Good to know. I mean, the exact opposite of when you're in high school and you're, oh God, please make it that my crush notices me. For her, she's, oh God, please make it that this man dies.
And then he dies. Are you there, God? It's me, Isabel. And it works. And it's not about your period. It's about killing the man who's going to ruin your life.
Oh my God.
Anyways, so Isabel was separated from her younger full brother, Alfonso, who, because he was male, was also had precedence over her claim. Alfonso was actually kept by Enrique's favorite, Juan Pachado, the brother of Pedro Grillon, who died on his way to try to get Isabel, who had considerable power and favor with the king. But when things soured between the two men, Juan decided to use Alfonso as a puppet to stage a rebellion against Enrique.
Ooh.
Side note, let's talk male favorites. Just two guys who are totally just friends.
Two guys sitting in a
hot tub
five feet apart because they're not gay.
This is where it gets complicated. So it's difficult to say what is the nature of this relationship. Enrique and Isabel's father had also been mentored by another older noble, Enrique Alvaro de Luna, who is said to control the king through witchcraft. When the king grew up, he put his own son Enrique into a mentor relationship with Juan Pachado. Was it abusive? Was it sexual? Was it guidance? We really don't know. But what we do know is that Enrique did whatever Juan Pachado wanted him to do.
Oh, God.
And it was often asked, who's the real king? Also, there was the lack of offspring, despite Enrique having two wives.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say at it, because unlike in some books where it was just, this was like grooming and blah, blah, I'm not getting into that. But what I am saying, though, is that there is a person who's of noble ability, but they're not the king, but apparently they're doing stuff above and beyond the king. So far that he's staging a rebellion against the king. But this guy, who is El Zorro in the book, keeps playing both sides.
Okay, so pretty much from what I'm gathering, Enrique had his BFF, maybe BF, we don't know, or abuser, we're not sure. And that guy is the one who was in charge of the rebellion of Alphonse. Wow, this family dinner, it just keeps on...
twisting. It keeps getting twisted. Alfonso is 15 and could have been on his way from turning from a puppet into an actual boy king. So Isabel took a risk and decided to ally herself with her full sibling, and they were reunited. But sadly, Alfonso died in 1468. In this book, they talk about their fun day at the fair and blah, 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 and then it had been a whole year since I had seen my brother, and then next thing you know, he's on death's door.
Yeah.
Was it foul play or just medieval times being gross and disease-ridden and plague?
We don't know.
We don't know. But Isabel was exposed and alone, and she had said stufu to Enrique, and she was the next one in line for the throne. So she needs a plan.
Yep.
And in the book, people who are saying, you should rebel and we'll support your cause and whatever. She's like, no, God told me I got to make peace with my brother. Whether or not it was God or Isabel being, I don't need to fight because I can just say, I'm sorry. He'll make me his heir and then I'll be queen either way.
And that was the thing. At this point, Queen Juana, like, disgraced because she had the child out of wedlock.
Yeah, she had had the bishop's nephew's son.
So, yeah, I mean.
So she was out. 2 months after the death of Alfonso, Isabel went to Enrique, and with a big show apology, she was recognized as his heir in 1468. But this was on the condition that she wouldn't marry without Enrique's consent.
Oof.
However, 17-year-old Isabel began her own secret marriage negotiations with Aragon to marry the heir, Fernando. She wrote him pretty saucy letters, and it was enough to make the 16-year-old agree he would respect her rights, acknowledge she was the true monarch, and he would also live in her kingdom. AKA, he's giving up everything.
When we say saucy, do we mean saucy? Or do we just mean she was, listen, this is what, these are my expectations. Either you get it or you don't.
It was intriguing enough. I'll say in terms of saucy like this. She waited until Enrique was going out of town, was all, I want to visit my mom and my dead brother's grave, and also to meet my secret future husband. They had an instant rapport, and basically, if the Bishop of Toledo wasn't there to chaperone, who knows how the two-hour meeting would have really gone.
Mm.
And those were said in Isabel's own words, not just in this diary, but in IRL too.
Wow.
So, at the age of 18, she married Fernando on October 19, 1469. So what's the deal with this Fernando guy?
Was there something in the air that night?
You thought buckle up before. I actually wrote in, buckle up, this gets wild.
Okay.
Fernando was the heir to the throne of Aragon, a smaller and less populated kingdom than Castile. Several months younger than Isabel, Fernando was already a figure of considerable fame by the time of their wedding. He had served his father, another Juan II, so many Juans, in the latter's wars.
It can't be just Juan.
So mad. He was also the king of Sicily and the heir for Aragon, Valencia, and Catalonia, which included the city of Barcelona. But Fernando was third in line. What had happened to his older siblings? Dun dun dun.
Oh god.
King Juan II of Aragon was the worst. He was upset.
I'm gonna say, like, there have been a lot of people who've been the worst, so.
No, everybody's the worst, but he's actually pretty bad.
Okay.
He was obsessed with Castile, and for two generations, the family wanted that kingdom. They tried conquering the old-fashioned way through war, but it was no good. So it was all about marriage relations after that. His first attempt to gain a foothold was in 1440, when he set up his daughter, Blanca, from his first marriage to marry Enrique, Isabel's half-brother. Remember I said Juana was the second wife? The first wife was Blanca!
Oh, gosh.
But maybe gay Enrique didn't consummate the marriage. She was sent back. Sorry, it just rhymed. It was funny.
Poor Blanca, though.
I know. So Juan II started on Plan the Second to put his son in the bed of Isabel and get controlled that way. Juan II didn't like his first family. His son Carlos was popular, and the people wanted him to be the king. Not Juan, who is basically causing trouble with all the neighboring kingdoms, was blind and kind of crazy. But when Fernando was 9, Carlos mysteriously got sick and died. The next person to get mysteriously sick and die was Blanca, the rejected queen of Castile. This is the backstory that created the favorite son, Fernando.
All obstacles in the way were taken care of, so conveniently, by God.
Dot, dot, dot. Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, Isabel had walked from one man controlling her life through marriage, her brother's choice of spouses, to another, her father-in-law, via his son.
Oh, God. This is monster-in-law, but instead of Jane Fonda, we have this.
Also, Fernando wanted to make the marriage happen and had forged the dispensation from the Pope to make it be legal.
He, like, forged her wedding license?
Yeah, because they were cousins and they needed the papal dispensation to be, it's cool. He faked that paperwork.
Wow.
To make it happen. And the Pope had sided with Isabel's brother, so Enrique, who didn't give his okay. So this is why Isabel would become obsessed with documenting things and getting the Pope's okay with stuff in the future. To get the official okay, Isabel turned to Rodrigo Borgia, who is the second to the guy who is planning on becoming the next Pope.
Wait a second, Rodrigo...
This is the same Rodrigo Borgia that you think it is!
Oh my god, so it's Jeremy Irons is chilling in Rome, eating grapes, and is... Oh, I see that I've received this
letter from Spain. Oh, who is this? Princess Isabel. Apparently my dispensation was not realsies. Can you make it real? Thanks.
This is an amazing crossover episode.
Exactly. It gets better. So Isabel was in a bit of political limbo until, in 1474, Enrique died. Although Enrique had the daughter Juana, his rule was unpopular and everyone just was straight up, she can't rule, she's a bastard princess. So Isabel made her move. At 23 years old, she walked into the church behind Enrique's coffin. Sad, sad, sad. Then she did a quick change and came out wearing royal robes and crowned herself on a platform in front of people. She gave a speech declaring she would defend the church and people of Castile and Leon. At the time, Ferdinand was away fighting a war, so he gets a net letter, "Hey hun, I's now queen. You wanna come home?" He was, "You made yourself queen without me?" And she's, "You gotta strike while the iron's hot, babe. No, wow. Chop, chop." So no woman had ruled the single largest realm in the Iberian Peninsula in more than 200 years. In many European countries, it was still illegal for a queen to rule in her own right, and Isabel was, "Nope, I'm the heir." So Princess Juana didn't give up without a fight. She went to her mother's people in Portugal and continued to sign her documents as queen, even though everybody knew it was a lost cause. Mm. And then eventually she was imprisoned by Isabel's daughter in the future. But the first 4 years of Isabel's reign were occupied by civil war. Upon the death of Juan II of Aragon that same year, the kingdoms of Castile and Aragon came together in the persons of the rulers. Mm. So we could finally get Castile and Aragon actually united.
Okay.
Isabel was now queen, but she had to get the financial situation in the kingdom sorted, stop lawlessness, and also retake Muslim Spain.
So she basically rolled up on the scene in the way that Cleopatra did, where she's, "All right, I'm gonna be your heir. I'm gonna be queen." But she's, "And I'm gonna have a lot of debt."
Yes, because civil wars are expensive. Do you know what's even more expensive? Taking back the rest of your land in the name of God.
Ugh.
Andalusian Muslim times and Isabel's need to get them out.
Gosh.
We're going on a journey further back in time. In the 8th century, Muslims had invaded and established their control over most of the peninsula. Al-Andalus, also known as Muslim Spain, was a Muslim kingdom that occupied much of the Iberian Peninsula from 711 CE until the collapse of the Spanish Umayyad dynasty in the early 11th century. From the mid-700s to 930, it was back and forth fighting over modern-day Spain and France between Muslims and Christians. But by 930, a golden age of Muslim Spain began. Abd Rahman III declared himself caliph, and underneath his rule, Cordoba grew up to become the largest and most cultured city in Europe. The seat of Europe's first Academy of Medicine, a center for geographers, architects, craftsmen, artists, scholars of every kind. Cordoba rivaled for a brief period the splendor of Baghdad.
When we were fortunate enough to go to Spain, I do remember going to the Great Mosque of Cordoba, mm-hmm. and that's still one of the most spectacular buildings I've ever been inside. It's mm-hmm. just staggering.
By the time Abd Rahman's death in 961, the Christian kingdoms had been thoroughly subjugated. Ambassadors from Leon, Navarre, Barcelona, and Castile all traveled to Cordoba to pledge their homage and pay tribute to the caliph. So the tables have turned.
How the turntables.
Exactly. So this golden age of Muslim Spain, some historians like to retroactively color it as like the most peaceful and magical time, which is not true. It was always war, back and forthing. So depending on who is in charge, the pecking order would change and whatever.
Yeah, like two truths can coexist, which is these people, they've been oppressed and persecuted. They have also oppressed and persecuted the people they occupy.
Exactly.
And, you know.
And it was back and forthing. So anytime Muslim people captured Christians, they immediately sold them to slavery, and as soon as Christians captured Muslim people, they sold them into slavery, and poor Jewish people were just always caught in the middle.
Oh, God.
And who always ended up having to pay taxes for just existing. Mm-hmm. Double. Anyways, but regardless, there was enough stability for art, culture, medicine, etc. to thrive. Fast forward to the second half of the 15th century. The Iberian Peninsula contained five separate states. In addition to the kingdoms of Aragon and Castile, there was the Kingdom of Portugal, the Muslim state of Granada, small principality of Navarre in the far north. The medieval history of Spain and Isabel's heritage was a history of war, often motivated by religious rivalries. Myth and facts were mixed in that heritage. One of the supposed founders of Spain's earliest civilization was Hercules. So the pillars, later named the Straits of Gibraltar, connecting Europe and Africa, those were Hercules pillars.
Interesting.
Yes. So Spanish royalty liked to trace its heritage to the German Goths who conquered Spain during the collapse of the Roman Empire, but also be like, we're also descendants from Hercules.
Like, we are literally from myth. It's, I'm Cleopatra, I'm descended from the gods.
Exactly.
I'm Elizabeth, I have been chosen and appointed by God.
And the Straits of Gibraltar were a big deal, not just because of this pseudo-mythology, but because that's how Muslims had originally come to Spain, via Africa.
Yeah.
So that was a big deal when they were, we gotta get those back.
Mm.
So it was an intolerant age, and the Moorish conquest had set off a long series of wars and battles known as the Reconquista. By the time of Isabel and Fernando, the process of reconquering Spain from the Muslims had gone on for centuries, and the Muslim presence had been reduced to Granada in southern eastern Spain. And that's where the Alhambra is.
Yes.
Like the the fortress palace. There was also the Ottoman Empire expanding from the east into Western Europe. The collapse of the Byzantine Empire, i.e. Eastern Orthodox Rome, and Christianity of the East happened in 1453, and that's when Isabel was 2 years old. So these were the dominant narratives of the time and her childhood. They're coming from the east to take over Europe, and they'll come from the south to take over the rest of Spain. Mm. Like, it's always on edge, aka the terrorists are out there.
Of course. Don't you just love how the same myths and narratives that we have now are just always recapitulated, and we never go and stop to pause and think, who perpetuates these myths? Who benefits from them? Is this not just a cycle of continual violence?
Exactly. Isabel was the main impetus behind the Granadan War, an almost decade-long war that really put a spotlight on the root of Isabel's motivations and ambitions. Was Isabel an intolerant religious fanatic who wiped out the corrupt and dwindling Muslim kingdom in a long and costly war for the sake of God? Or was it a calculated political move that would establish the foundations for united Spain of the future?
Why can't we have both?
It could be both. Other divisions had long existed in Castile and the rest of Spain. There were regional rivalries, cities fighting for freedom from local aristocrats, almost entirely independent from royal control. These divisions were centuries old and common throughout Western civilization in the Middle Ages. By the 15th century, centralized and powerful monarchies were becoming the norm at the expense of regional and aristocratic independence. No, I'm the king, and the queen. Like, enough of this nonsense. Answer to me. In Spain, with its medieval history of Reconquista and the most recent evolution of centralized monarchies, it was perhaps inevitable that Castile and Aragon, united by marriage, would wage war of conquest against neighboring Granada with its predominantly Muslim population. Isabel's motives were mixed, but religion was of primary importance. Put a pin in that in terms of the Muslim situation.
Oh gosh.
The political and religious divisions in Spain were not only between Muslims and Christians. There was also a large Jewish population.
Of course.
Jewish people had been in Spain since the Roman era, and Spain's Jewish community was perhaps the largest in Europe. Until the late 14th century, Jews were looked down upon, but generally tolerated and protected by rulers because of financial and other services rendered to monarchs. Mm. So they were part of their treasury and also advisors.
It's like how in the book, they're the moneylenders or the merchants. Like, they do all this work, but they don't labor. But Catalina's point is they're not allowed to own land. They can't own property.
Yeah, it's the only kind of work we can actually get into. But in the aftermath of the Black Death in the 1340s and economic depression, Jews naturally became the scapegoat.
It's almost as if, again, we just...
It keeps cycling
depression.
Through, yeah. Victim of fear and prejudice. Yeah. We'll just leave it at that. Many Jewish people died, fled, and others converted to Christianity. There were numerous conversos among the leading advisors to various rulers, and they were a significant element in intellectual circles. Many were members of the Catholic clergy. Religious orthodoxy was a paramount concern to Isabel and her court. Religious issues had dominated medieval life in politics and war, purely in spiritual matters. But by the end of the 15th century, the means were more readily available to enforce orthodoxy than in an earlier age. This leads us to, remember I said there was the 1 year that's basically the be all and end all of seasons?
Yeah.
Get ready.
Oh god.
1492, the year everything happens. The surrender of Granada.
Oh gosh, okay.
Abu al-Hasan, the current Muslim ruler in Granada, thought Isabel coming to the throne was a sign that Castile was weakening and refused to pay tribute. There's a lady in charge. What is this nonsense? Well, Isabel wasn't having that. This is where the team of Isabel and Fernando would shine in the best worst way. Greater financial resources at the crown's disposal as a result of increased trade and commerce gave the monarchs added leverage within and without their kingdoms. Gunpowder arrival in Europe added power available to rulers and generals. Leadership also made a difference, and here is where Isabel played a critical role. Although Granada's days as an independent Muslim state were already numbered, the successful 10-year campaign against Granada that ended in 1492 was a large part of Isabel's endeavors. Not in the battlefield, that was Fernando, but by giving focus on religious and nationalistic feelings and keeping Castilians and Aragonese armies well supplied with the necessities of war.
Basically, she was the PR and the Jeff Bezos Amazoning, priming out stuff for people.
Pretty much. She was the behind the scenes making it all happen.
Oh, chess had existed. It almost makes it worse.
I know. Chess, I know, because Fernando was her blood instrument.
Yeah.
At the front of it, but at the end of it, who's actually wielding that club?
Yeah.
Exactly. Chess had existed for centuries, which is also very interesting throughout the book. Chess is peppered throughout this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was originally from India, but it wasn't until the late 15th century, when Isabel was at the height of her powers, that the queen became the most powerful piece. According to chess historians, in its original form, the equivalent of the queen was a male piece known as the Spanish alfereza from the Persian, meaning something like a vizier. The figure was weak and the movements were limited. Later, in 1475, when Isabel was crowned queen of Castile, the figure became female, but was only able to move one square at a time, like the king. Not until 1495, when Isabel was the most powerful woman in Europe, were the present rules of chess established, in which the queen roams freely in all directions on the board. After 10 years of fighting, the path was clear, and on January 2nd, Bobadil, the keeper of the keys of the Alhambra, the fortified crown jewel of a palace, handed them over to Queen Isabel, and she and Fernando and their heir, Juan, walked through the gates.
I mean, I don't know what's, like, more of a surprise that, like, she influenced chess, that's wild to me, or it's that, I don't care if it's 10 years, I don't care if it's 20 years, I'm just gonna go wreck these people's lives.
Which, obviously, when you think about it in terms of real people's lives being destroyed, you're like, this is terrible. But when you think about poetic cinema,
the symbolism
of that's what chess is, and I'm like, chef's kiss. I couldn't write it better myself.
Wow.
So the conquest of Granada was viewed throughout Europe as the most significant military achievement of Christian forces in centuries. It was viewed as partial compensation for the great loss of the Christian capital of Constantinople. Now that Isabel had keys to the kingdom, she decided it was time to formally clean house.
Oh, lordy.
Here we go. Always suspect the Spanish Inquisition.
Oh, great.
In the spring of 1492, that's right, we're still on season 1492.
We're still on season 1492.
This is a wild season.
I know it is. They should just do a mini-series of 1492.
I know. Spain's practicing Jews were ordered to leave the country within 3 months. This decision was as much Isabel's as anyone else's. The Spanish Jewish community numbered approximately 175,000 out of a total population of 5 million people. It's like a blip. Doesn't matter. Like the Muslims, Jews have been in Spain, like I said, for centuries. And in the past, even during Isabel's own reign, the crown had generally taken the Jewish community under its protection. But by 1492, that changed. Many Jews had previously converted to Christianity, but in the heightened climate of the times, even conversos became suspect. Many claimed that Jews were tainted by blood and could not be wiped away. Moors and Jews, converted or not, were likely candidates for one of the most notorious institutions associated with the reign of Isabel, the Spanish Inquisition.
I mean, that whole tainted by blood thing, too, is even brought up in the book as well.
But it is interesting, too, though, how, in terms of that respect, how the book doesn't shy away from that, and it doesn't try to be like, maybe it was a misunderstanding. No, this lady is straight up
anti-Semitic. Yeah.
And she's being tainted with this garbage, and she's taking it within herself instead of questioning it. She sounds good to me.
And I'm just gonna go and do it, because I want to affirm my narrow worldview.
So what do you, before I get into the Inquisition, because this actually was a learning point for me, what do you know about the Spanish Inquisition, besides Monty Python?
I mean, I know that people were horrifically tortured. A lot of the torture implements or like horror imagery we have comes from the Spanish Inquisition.
Mm-hmm.
I know that a lot of people were sold into slavery and they were deported too as well to like what would eventually become like the New World colonies. It was pretty much, it was terrible.
Well,
like, there's no other way to go and really say it.
Well, I'm going to read to you a little bit more about this, but this was something that was a learning for me, which was that I always viewed the Spanish Inquisition in the realm of like, oh, heresy. You're not believing Catholicism, therefore you're a heretic, therefore we're going to burn you.
Yeah.
And I always thought it through like a Protestant lens.
Yeah.
But that's actually not where it came from and how it originated.
Oh.
So I'm going to read to you about this. And actually, it wasn't until later on, because Protestants didn't exist at this point.
No.
So obviously, it wasn't done to persecute Protestants. So how did it show up? Let's read this terrible stuff. The Inquisition only applied to people who formally identified themselves as Christian, but their behavior caused others to doubt their sincerity.
Oh my god, this is like 1950. 1984 wrong think shit.
It's wrong think, it's Salem witch trials, it's all these things. It's satanic panic. In Isabel's lifetime, the Inquisition was focused mostly on conversos, people of Jewish descent who had publicly converted and called themselves Christians. Initially, it didn't apply to Muslims or Jews. Instead, the goal was to ferret out insincere Christians. And if they were found guilty, correct them. If they were seen as unrepentant, kill them by burning them for the penalty of heresy. When Isabel and Fernando decided that Jews were corrupting the conversos, they decided everyone has to get baptized or get out. The Inquisition panel was formally launched in 1480, but this was a time of war when things were unstable. But after 1492, it started becoming a real effective tool of government repression and giving out rules and a convenient way to suppress enemies and punish various types of social nonconformity that the majority of the population found irritating or unwanted.
So this is like Soviet and like Nazi show trials.
It very much so, and it's like you are making life difficult for the general population, so it's easier for me to just call you out and take care of you than I don't really care, you do you. Basically, failing to conform to religious and political norms is treason. So if you question God, you're actually questioning the king or the queen because they're there by divine right. So if you're like, I don't know about God, you questioning God? That means you don't trust the queen. That means that you're treasonous because you don't like the queen. And it's a vice versa thing too, where you're like, I don't like the queen. Well, then you must not like God, so I'm gonna burn you.
Wow. You cannot win.
You are just screwed. To prove your sincerity, if you were accused, you were told to denounce others. If you didn't, then your confession would be considered insincere and you were screwed. So by throwing people under the bus, you could maybe survive. So it's basically the witch trials. I accuse you as a witch. The only way to get out of this accusation of witch is you tell me where the other witches are. Witch, I'm not a witch. Ding, ding, ding is a witch. Thank you for your confession. We like that you acknowledge that you're a witch and you told us who the other real witches are. We'll let you stay alive so you can tell us who the other witches are, but we'll kill those other witches.
She's a witch. She's a witch.
Exactly.
She floats. She's like a duck. Get a duck.
What is the same weight as a duck? It was more than souls, though. It was obviously a cash grab.
Of course.
The way it worked was sequestration, confiscation, and sale. You're arrested for heresy. You have to declare all your possessions. If you lied or admitted something extra, extra bad news for you. Your stuff is then taken, debts are paid off, and if you weren't convicted, you would get what was left of your stuff back. If you were convicted, the Inquisition treasury would keep it, and the crown would auction off your possessions. And your relatives could not purchase the stuff back.
Wow.
If you are trying to finance some wars, what's the best way to do it? I'm accused old Mr. Moneybag over there. I think he's a little suspect. Oh, wait, I take his money. He can't prove that he's not down with Jesus, so I guess I keep his money.
On one hand, it's a level of obvious like evilness, of terribleness, but wow, it is a very effective business model.
It is, which is why they kept it. In a papal bull of 1489, the Pope basically called out the Inquisition for what it was. Not zeal for faith and salvation of souls, but lust of wealth, and many true and faithful Christians on testimonies of enemies, rivals, and fewer or lesser proper persons without proof are thrust into secular prisons, tortured, condemned, as a relapse of heretics deprived of their goods and property are handed over to the secular arm to be executed. So even the Pope was WTF.
I mean, the Pope is also going and saying that this ain't cool, you might want to go and chill. And that's the thing, is the Pope thinks you're going too far.
I know, and the Pope was pretty much down for saving souls, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
The Spanish Inquisition was vicious and tragic. Isabel had lost the industry and artistry of the Jewish people and Muslims who had lived there for hundreds or even thousands of years. The Inquisition and the religious intolerance it represents forms a dark mark against her legacy that continues to haunt Spain. But from Isabel's perspective, it united Spain and allowed it to quell internal religious dissension and look outward. It was one of the largest, and from Isabel's point of view, one of the most successful forced conversions in Spanish history. Eliminating outsiders has its advantages, and religious tolerance is not a universal concept. And now, Spain was ready to become one of the greatest world powers ever known. 1492 continues with exploring and global domination.
Oh gosh, it's like we have
I'm telling you, it's Inception layers. It's like boom.
Well, it's like we're gonna go and have the conquest of a Muslim state. We're gonna go and have the expulsion of Jewish people and anti-Semitic laws being enshrined. And now colonialism is like bitch, you rang? I'm here.
It's like that gif of that, hey, and it's sashaying in.
Pretty much.
In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Christopher Columbus encountered the New World. And by encountered, I mean he ran into it, and God, he ran into it. After years of negotiation and procrastination, and 3 months after the decree to expel the unconverted Jewish people, Isabel and Fernando made the final decision to support Columbus's expedition. Columbus really didn't care anybody pay for this. And he was basically playing between Portugal and Spain. And finally, Isabel was, we're gonna just do this so A, you will leave me alone, and B, screw Portugal.
Well, yeah, because that's another thing too. It's talked about in the book about how Portugal has started its conquests within the African continent. It's like, yeah, we're gonna take your gold, we're gonna go and steal your people. And
yeah,
it's like,
Portugal was already on that.
Yeah, it's like, we haven't taken this slave trade transatlantic yet, but we're still gonna go and be getting that system set up.
We're working on it.
Ugh.
Yeah, like those of his sponsor, Isabel, Columbus's motivations were a combination of religious idealism, political and military power, economic wealth, and personal ambition, and a diverse and contradictory combination that was representative of the times. It's like, I want to save but also conquer people. And it's like, what?
Mm-hmm.
For Isabel, Columbus's proposal continued her long-stated intent to colonize and control the Canary Islands and the Atlantic and Mediterranean coasts of Africa, i.e., I'm gonna screw you over, Portugal. There is a story that Isabel pawned her jewels to finance Columbus's first voyage, but the royal jewels were mostly business collateral. He actually didn't care that much.
Oh,
For Isabel, she was just get out of here.
See,
most people weren't expecting anything to happen.
I think it also really says something, though, when you're at a level of power. I just, don't really care about it. But regardless, the result of it is the forced conquest and colonization of two continents.
Yeah. For Isabel, the unexpected discoveries quickly brought fresh problems, not the least which was the relationship of the newly discovered, in quotes, Indians, because Columbus thought he was finding India, but he found Haiti.
But that's the thing, though. How dumb can you be? Because people had been to India beforehand at this point. I don't know. Columbus just really sounds like a dumbass. He's like the ultimate white man who failed up the corporate ladder.
Oh, man. And then he fails his way down.
He does?
I'm happy to share that with you.
Oh, thank God.
The queen and her counselors were more ready to recognize the rights of the indigenous people than Columbus. She ordered some of those he had brought back as slaves to be released. Oh. So he's like, I have gold and slaves. She's like, let these people go, you weirdo. The queen was still concerned with the problems like this when she died in 1404, since Columbus was going out of his way to be a genocidal monster with native people. Columbus's four voyages were brilliantly successful for Spain and Europe, but a personal failure for the Admiral of the Ocean Sea. That was the title that they gave him. Mm-hmm. Columbus's governance of Hispaniola, aka what is now modern-day Dominican Republic and Haiti, was brutal and tyrannical. Native islanders who didn't collect enough gold had their hands cut off. Rebel Spanish colonists were executed at the gallows. Colonialists complained to the monarch about mismanagement, and the royal commissioner dispatched to Hispaniola arrested Columbus in August of 1500 and brought him back to Spain in chains only 3 weeks before Isabel's death. Although Columbus was stripped of his governorship, King Fernando, Fernando, we were in a good place, not only granted the explorers freedom, but also subsidized a fourth voyage. Fernando, we were in a good place. This guy was in chains and was disgraced, but then Isabel died, and then Fernando was, boys will be boys, and Fernando, you suck!
Columbus's reign of terror in Haiti and Dominican Republic sounds quite a bit like Leopold II with the Belgian Free Congo.
Very much so. Horrifically be summarized up by the wonderful illustrated comic by The Oatmeal, We Should Stop Having Columbus Day. In the next 120 years of Spain's discovery, and I say this with air quotes, 70,000 churches, 500 monasteries, 300 schools and hospitals would be built along with four universities. But also, $1.5 billion in gold and silver was taken, and millions of lives were lost to disease, starvation, and slavery, and straight-up massacre. Isabel wanted to make sure that the benefits of the expedition would accrue to her kingdom and people. She wanted to make sure that the Pope recognized that anything discovered by Spain was theirs, and thankfully for her, the Pope was an old friend, Rodrigo Borgia himself.
Oh my God!
Chapter 4 of 1492. As luck would have it, Rodrigo Borgia was elected pope in August of 1492.
Oh my god.
The same month that Columbus set out for his voyage of discovery.
Oh gosh.
It was only the second time in history that a Spaniard had been named the church's highest office, and his tenure was to be memorable in many ways.
I mean,
not just because of Jeremy Irons' magnificent performance in Showtime.
I know, I was about to say.
Rodrigo's rise at the Vatican occurred in parallel with that of his countrymen back home in Spain, whose prestige was growing almost daily. Rodrigo Borgia had played up those associations by staging an elaborate celebration in the streets of Rome when Isabel and Fernando completed the 700-year Reconquista in January of 1492. The event was celebrated in Rome with illuminations, bonfires, and diversions of every kind, including a bullfight in which five bulls were slain. The first entertainment of its kind that had ever been seen in Rome, and that was a special contribution by Cardinal Rodrigo Borgia.
So pretty much that bitch was, yo, I'm gonna use this for my own PR, because as we know, because of the very historically accurate Showtime series, The Borgias, he was actually really good at PR.
He was.
I know more about Rodrigo Borgia, all of his ridiculous family, than I did about Isabella and Ferdinand growing into this, so I feel a lot more like on level ground right now.
Well, and I would also like to say that show and also the European counterpart Borgia, chef's kiss, amazing. But that right there is where I said about earlier how shows will cram significant key events over 4 or 5 years into like 3 or 4 episodes. You don't need to do that in this.
Nope.
Whereas like in that show, they were just boom, boom, boom. And I was like, really? These things happened in the same week? No. It was like many years.
Yeah.
The resounding victory of Granada was no small thing for Cardinal Borgia, because Italians who predominated in the church hierarchy look on foreigners with contempt. Rodrigo's high position left him vulnerable to criticism as an outsider, and he valued his ties and support from home. Spain's increasing prestige increased his own. But the relationship between Rodrigo Borgia and the Spanish sovereigns had encountered some stumbling blocks. When Isabel heard about Rodrigo's rise to the papal tiara in early fall of 1492, she was conflicted. Borgia was a subject of theirs, which of course was advantageous to Fernando and Isabel, and she knew him personally. Remember, he helped her obtain the throne and also gave her that piece of paper saying, your marriage is for realsie. And he started off on good note, promising to reform the church and cleanse Rome of like street crime and make things right. But Isabel had serious concerns about the now Pope Alexander VI's morality and fitness for the post of such importance. Publicly, she and Fernando expressed pleasure at the news, but privately, they indicated reservations. Although Rodrigo was brilliant and had great potential for good, he also demonstrated troubling character flaws, a ferocious ambition in seeking to advance the fortunes of his many illegitimate children.
Yes.
It's a little bit of a conundrum there.
I mean, I remember when I first found out about Rodrigo Borgia and be like, wait, he had kids? Like, that was a thing? And I was a little like, duh. And I was, but me, an innocent child, was like,
what? But he's a priest. I don't understand.
Exactly.
Yeah. Similar concerns were being raised by idealistic and pious Christians across Europe who believed the church was becoming more dangerously corrupt and the secular power of the papacy was growing. Many devout Spaniards, including Isabel, were disturbed by this state of affairs. She was doing much to try to evaluate the morals and standards of the Catholic Church in Spain. So it's particularly disheartening to see some serious misconducts at the apex of the church hierarchy in Rome. Here she is trying to be all good Catholic people, convert or get out and blah, blah, blah. And then the Pope, who's Spanish, is meet my children, meet my mistress. And it's what the hell? But regardless of her differences between Isabel and Rodrigo, even though she was IRL, your personal life is a mess and it does not match up with your public life as Pope. I need actual business from you.
Okay.
As soon as she received word from Columbus about his discoveries, she set out to make certain that she would have sole right to whatever was found. So she forwarded Columbus's letter to the Pope asking for a determination of the ownership of these islands, aka Haiti and now Dominican Republic, and the Bahamas, even before Columbus arrived in the court. For Isabel, it was a big boon. He wanted to accommodate Isabel and promptly issued 4 bulls in the New World. So, you know, bulls, like legal documents stamped.
Yeah.
And so essentially,
I used to think those were like actual bulls, though, as a small child.
I mean, because it's bulla, that's what it means, like a stamp.
Mm, so the more you know.
Exactly. In the formal introductions in all 4 documents, the Pope greeted both Fernando and Isabel. But interestingly, the bulls gave the discovered lands specifically to the rulers of Castile and Leon, meaning the lands that belonged to Isabel alone.
Whoop.
Fernando, always quick to angle for a personal advantage, must have thought the new lands would prove to be relatively valueless. Otherwise, he probably would have been, can you put my name on there too? The bull dated May 4th in 1493, known as Inter Catera, neatly gave half the globe to Queen Isabel.
Don't you just love the way how...
It's wild.
I mean, yeah.
So Pope Alexander stressed, however, that the rights were granted the expedition that religious evangelization was the primary object of enterprise of discoveries. So I'll give you half the world only to make them Christian. That's the real reason. Only Christian.
He expected... Yeah, Isabel's like, well, I'm really great at that. You should see our country.
He expected Fernando and Isabel to build upon their record of success of expanding Catholicism in Spain. Yeah. The Queen and Pope shared a belief in the importance of the discoveries of the New World, and the sense that the Church was destined to make great progress there. The Pope's quick appreciation of the issue paved a way for Isabel to impose her own religious values in ways both good and bad in an entire new hemisphere. She brought Castilian-style education, healthcare, political systems, and spiritual values to millions of people. She also introduced the Inquisition to the New World soon after it took its root in Spain.
Like, she brought in, like, education, all these other things. I'm like, oh yes, because indigenous people for the millions of years, like thousands of years, they have been chilling all over there. Never learned anything, never developed their own systems, know nothing. All they were just chilling around, waiting for the fucking white people to show up.
Yeah, they were like, I wish white people would come so I could go to school. It also meant the uniquely Spanish combination of intellectual inclinations, so broad-mindedness and secular manners, combined with intolerance of religious differences, made the leap across the ocean, where it would affect cultural and political life in Latin America for more than 500 years.
Yeah, still not over.
But the Pope's most valuable gift to Isabel and to Spain's future was the fact that he carved the world in half and gave an important part to Isabel. All in all, it was an extraordinary transaction. The first, that an individual would have the audacity to divide up the planet. And second, that the Catholic Church was so powerful that many people for generations to come never even questioned the ruling. The gift was immediately questioned by the native indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
When they were later informed that the Pope had taken the land occupied by millions of them and ceded it to Europeans, with a wave of a pen and a dollop of wax, they struggled to grasp the concept that one man, the Pope, would believe himself to have enough power over heaven and earth. When it was described to Chinu chiefs in Colombia in 1512, they shook their heads in wonder. The Pope must have been drunk, they said to each other.
God, I mean, Lord, give me the capacity and the audacity of an old white man.
So Isabel's family and legacy. So Isabel's public accomplishments were, according to the standards of the time, greatly admired. The unification of Spain, the expulsion of Muslims and Jewish people, the beginning of the conquest and colonization of the New World, establishment of possibly the strongest monarchy in Europe, were considered marvelous accomplishments at the time. But her personal life was not as fulfilling.
You know what? That's what she deserves.
That's what I was saying. Newton's law. Every action, equal and opposite, probably worse reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Isabel and Fernando had a lot in common. They were not the first to be considered heirs. They grew up surrounded by war and civil unrest. Isabel had never seen a functional marriage, and she was raised by nuns and governesses. And she tried to do domestic things like make Fernando shirts for him. Because that's what you do when your governess is a nun, and it's, I guess I make shirts.
Mm-hmm.
Fernando also didn't know how to be functional in a marriage because he was a cheater from day one.
Wow.
He would go off on campaigns and didn't make his affairs a secret. After all, he had come into the marriage with two illegitimate children.
I did not know that. Wow.
Do you remember Isabel's BFF, Beatriz?
Oh, no.
She had a niece, also called Beatriz, who Fernando had an affair with.
I just want to go and say that they're
the audacity.
I know, the audacity, but also there really was something in the air that night for Fernando.
Nando, I know. Isabel married off this second Beatriz and made her live on the Canary Islands. This was basically her way of trying to deal with this kind of nonsense in the marriage. She'd know about the affair, she'd marry the girl off, and send her packing. Repeat. He loved and resented her power, so Isabel made concessions to his ego, obviously.
Of course.
His name could come first, meaning, and he could be on the other side of her coins. Their motto was Monta tanto, tanto monta, meaning as one is, so is the other. Basically, whatever Fernando says is what Isabel says, and vice versa. Isabel's symbol was the arrow, or flecha, the F for Fernando. Fernando's was a yoke, or yogo, for Isabel, with a Y.
Oh.
These two entwined symbols, you can find them all over Spain, and this was good for their present relationship. It worked for them, and people knew that she was actually in charge of Castile. But historians would then didn't later wrongly assume he was in charge because his name came first. And that reminds me when we went to Spain and we actually saw their resting place.
Yep.
And how I loved our guide because you can see on the effigies, her head is lower than his. And he's, do you know why this is? And I was like, it's because I think she's less than a woman and blah, blah, blah. He's, this is probably true at the time. But what I like to say is because she was the real brains of the relationship, her head's heavier than his. Thank you, Spanish historian, for this revisionist history. That is actually not revisionist. It is accurate.
Amazing. I do remember that now.
It was priceless. Isabel had 5 living children. The children were how Spain would have allies, but Isabel herself had valued a love match for what it was with Fernando.
And at least for her.
For what it was, you know, and in who knows, in their own messed up way, blah, blah, blah. So age appropriate, rank, intellectual connection, these things were very important to her. And they did, she did have those for Fernando. Her first daughter, Isabel, was born in 1470. She married Alfonso, Prince of Portugal, but they had no children. He died suddenly shortly after they were married, so she came home until it was decided she would marry the younger brother, Manuel of Portugal.
Makes sense.
Isabella was a very sensitive and religious person. She thought because the Jewish people had been expelled from Spain and were hiding in Portugal, God was angry about that. So he killed her first husband. Not because the Jews had been expelled, but because they were in Portugal where her husband had died.
Oh, so she,
if this is true,
that is a level of mental gymnastics, but at the same time, they're so freaking wackadoodle. It makes complete sense.
Exactly. But if this is true, God was probably more angry about Portugal's own Inquisition under Manuel and Isabel because she died in childbirth in 1498, thus putting a damper on Portuguese ambitions to rule Spain, which various rulers had harbored since the reign of King Fernando I. Manuel and Isabel's younger son, Miguel de Paz, named Prince of Austria as Prince of Portugal, Prince of Guiana, was the heir apparent for Castile, Portugal, and Aragon. But then he unfortunately died in 1500 at the age of 2.
Oof.
So that was Isabel's grandson who was going to be her heir. Thus ending the ambitions of the Catholic monarchs and Manuel. Isabel had a son, but it was a miscarriage in 1475. So she was campaigning in this 10-year campaign. She's riding a horse and all this stuff. Her only son, Juan, died at the age of 19. And that was her heir. He had just been married to Archduchess Margaret of Austria, but died shortly afterwards. They had no children. Juana was her next daughter. She married Philip the Handsome, who was Margaret of Austria's brother. So it was a sibling double wedding.
Okay.
Juana had a son, Charles V, who eventually inherited Spain and the Habsburg Empire. After the death of her older siblings, Juana became Isabel's heir. Yes.
I was just gonna say, Charles V, is that the same one that gets mentioned frequently in Elizabeth and Mary?
Yes, it is.
Oh my god.
Charles V is Mary I's cousin who she wanted to marry.
And then he had a son. Philip.
Who Mary ended up marrying. It's messy. Juana became Isabel's heir, but Juana herself proved to be a difficult daughter, perhaps as a result of mental instability. She's given the soubriette Juana la Loca, like the mad. But was she crazy or just gaslit by a horrible husband who cheated on her all the time, kept her from her money, her family, and her children? After her awful husband died, Juana was upset about it. And was this the familial depression that both her mother and grandmother had both suffered from? Or was it a smear campaign by her father trying to control the throne after Isabel died? Juana was accused of being crazy and carting around her dead husband's body. But the reality was, she had no place to bury it because her dad was trying to catch her and imprison her because he kept saying she was crazy.
I just want to say that Ferdinand is, like, the worst.
He is. She was running around with this dead body and people were like, she's crazy, she won't let him go. But it's, no, she just didn't want to abandon him somewhere. So he was, like, embalmed and she had him in a box. So, eventually she was caught and imprisoned until she died in 1555. Fernando took over the throne until his death, and then her son Charles, like I said, came to power and united Spain and the Habsburg Empire. So then we have, like, the Holy Roman Empire, including Spain.
Damn.
Maria was Isabel's next daughter, and she was born while her mother was in war council. Her mom went into labor while she was in war council and the retaking of Granada, and she gave birth. There was also a stillborn twin sister who had died the morning afterwards. Maria, this is where it gets complicated. So remember how Isabel, the first daughter, married the brother of her first husband, Manuel, and then she died in childbirth?
Yep.
Well, Maria married Manuel, the first of Portugal, her sister Isabel's widower.
These family dinners.
I know. They had the same focus on religious missionaries and Christian indoctrination in the New World like Isabel. The Portuguese sent many missionaries to Africa, South America, and Asia, swelling the numbers of the faithful. They had two sons later became kings of Portugal. Maria died in 1517. And her last daughter, Catalina, our favorite, Catherine of Aragon.
Ugh.
Born in July 1st in 1485, Catherine first married Arthur, the son and heir of the English king, Henry VII. Then, after Arthur's early death, she married Henry's second son, who became Henry VIII. She was the mother of Mary I of England. Uh-huh. The failure of the marriage to produce any male heirs led to divorce and the sundering of the Christian church between England and Rome. The schism happened. So this is basically how everything goes down for Isabel. In 1495, Juan, her heir, dies. In 1498, her older daughter, her favorite, Isabel, dies. In 1500, the grandson, Miguel, dies. So this was just too much for Isabel to handle. It was a psychological and physical blow to both her, and her health started to fail. This is when more of those dour, careworn Isabel portraits show up, when she just looks like real bad. I understand why. Isabel had secured the papal dispensation for her youngest daughter, Catalina, to be safe and securely married to Henry before she took to her bed and died. Very end. Gotta get that paperwork.
Yeah, of course.
Fernando was there. Beatriz, her childhood BFF, was there. She made Fernando promise, don't get married again, so Juana's inheritance wouldn't be taken. He promised, and then broke that promise and married less than a year later to a young French princess to end the fighting with France. The princess was young enough to be his daughter.
Ugh!
Isabel's last recorded action was making the sign of the cross before dying on November 26, 1504, at the age of 53. Spain went into a tailspin at her death, but within 20 years, building on the foundation she had laid, Spain became the world's first global superpower. Her influence was profound on Ferdinand, on Spain, the New World, and on Europe. It seems readily apparent that her religious prejudices, her political ambitions, her personal attitudes reflected many of the virtues and vices found in Western civilization. Isabel was a woman with far-reaching vision. When Fernando wanted to wage a war of vanity against the Kingdom of Naples, which he considered to be ancient territory of his homeland Aragon, Isabel was thinking bigger. She wanted to unite Spain in territory, mind, and religion. It's a testament to Isabel's intelligence and will. She's so well known in our age, when women too easily fade into obscurity. For all, like I said, about the winds, so many fails, and sort of like ripples that continue onward.
Like sand through the hourglass.
But when you talk about dynamic people that actually made history, she made history.
Yeah, I mean...
And that's all I'll say about that. I'm not saying it's good. I'm not saying it's bad. I mean, I will say it's bad.
I was about to say, like,
It's terrible.
Like, the attitudes of 15th and 16th century Europe. I'm like, more like now.
Well, and that's something to be mindful of, too. It's how far removed are we from history and attitudes were like, was in the past. I'm like, was it?
Yeah, or it's a, you know, the methods might have changed, but the same systems and power structures are still
and the same
enforced.
Justifications, mm-hmm. where everybody has a good reason because it's the reason that I've come up with.
Exactly.
So, with those takeaways, you can learn a lot. Do's and don'ts, more like don'ts.
Yeah.
A lot of don'ts.
Pretty much.
And, yeah. But wasn't that wild, though? Like, so much happened in such a one small time. That is wild.
It's almost difficult to fathom how much went on, and I am really looking forward to that miniseries.
I know. It'll be awesome. We should watch the one that Spain made.
We should.
Except I feel like they might be too nice about Isabel.
We can just go and write a really strongly worded review on Amazon.
But I think they show Fernando for, like, the real D-bag that he is.
Which, I have to say, that was something that I didn't know about. And it's, you know, it's like, what were you expecting? He is a man. But,
and also, I will say this. When anyone's, it was Isabel and Ferdinand, or Fernand and Isabel. Excuse me. What did that bitch do after she died? Nothing. He literally did nothing except marry a teen bride and cause shit for people until he died. So, I'm just saying, Isabel, she may have done horrible stuff, but she actually did the stuff, so the writing's on the wall. That's all her.
Oh my God.
The bad of it is all hers, but she did the stuff. It was not Ferdinand.
It was not Ferdinand, and the stuff was
the stuff. There's no good way of wrapping this one up.
No, there isn't. My final thoughts on this, and then I'm going to shut up,
all right,
is, wow, okay then. Those are at your life. Look at your choices. And worst thing is, she will look at her life, and she will look at her choices, and she would be fine with them.
She would be fine with them. And that's why when you're 16 years old praying that God kills your awful suitor, maybe he shouldn't die, because then you think that you have the power to kill people. Because God is your best friend.
Exactly.
Follow us for more research, fun facts, soundtracks, and aesthetic posts. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter at Royal Diaries Pod.